Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Movie Geeks United. It's great to bring you the show tonight. Jerry, how are you?
Great to bring this show. I mean, I'm doing all right. How are you doing? I was trying to, like, you know, to recapture the moment between Charles Grodin and Johnny Carson where he turned the tables on Carson, you know, because he asked, well, what goes through your mind on this show, you know? It was one of those great Grodin-esque moments, but I failed miserably, so let's get on with the program, shall we?
Actually, you remember, my favorite appearances on Letterman used to be Charles Grodin, because they used to give each other, like, a really hard time between Letterman and Grodin.
I think Grodin gave everyone a hard time. I mean, just look at Midnight Run. You know, I think he wasn't acting in that. I think he was, hey, I'm playing Charles Grodin, deal with it.
Yeah. Well, that at least he has, like... a shining light, like a beacon in his film career, and Midnight Run is it.
You don't think the...
Seems Like Old Times? No.
wait, you don't like Seems Like Old Times?
I actually really dig Seems Like Old Times. I always like that movie.
Because he's playing himself in that movie, too. I mean...
Yeah, but there's just something about his chemistry with De Niro and... You know.
Oh, yeah, it's perfect in that film. It's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I don't see how they can replicate that in the...
sequel
you talked about.
Yeah, no, I had read that a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, Grodin is, I did not realize this, but I guess he is actually officially retired from acting,
mm-hmm.
So he's not going to come back for it. So I'm thinking, who do you get to play that opposite De Niro?
I'm just happy if he's retired from his talk show, because that was like, that would put, remember his talk show?
Yes, I do. Was he now? Let me ask you this though, because I don't remember the exact time frame. But was he one of the guys on CNBC and all those who made it? Who made it though? He created a talk show during the O.J. Simpson trial. Was it around that time?
It probably was, but
remember,
it was just
everyone got a talk show. Like everyone associated with that trial, or who got a talk show somehow through that.
Hearing him drone on and on. Would put coffee to sleep. I mean, it was...
Damn, that's a harsh indictment right there.
It was just unbearable. But he's great in Midnight Run.
No, he's perfect in that.
All right, we got... we're going to cover some movie news, and I've seen some movies, Jerry. I'm sure you have too. And
I watched Seven again last night. That's what I watched.
Oh, good, good.
Trying to keep up to date with everything, trying to do my homework, as it were. You know, trying to do my homework, Jamie, you know?
Yeah, welcome to the 20th century. Did you watch Ghost Rider?
The Ghost Rider, yes. I watched the Ghost Rider a couple weeks ago.
Okay. I saw it this week, so we'll be able to talk about that on the other side of this interview, and a lot more.
Okay,
what a
that
teaser.
That sounds good, all right.
And we're also going to be joined by Chris in a in a few. But first, let's get to our interview for this show. This is a good one. Stolen is the feature film debut of director Anders Anderson, and this tightly wound family drama thriller hybrid stars Josh Lucas and John Hamm, which are both sensational in the movie. It's currently playing in New York and L.A., and it's available on all video on demand systems. We had the pleasure of speaking with director Anderson and the film's co-producer and director of photography, Andy Steinman, about the experience of making the film, and here's what they had to say. First off, to start off the conversation here, tell me a little bit about yourselves and and what inspired you to get into filmmaking from the beginning. Anders, if you want to start out with that.
Sure, definitely. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I started off, and my background is basically in exercise science and Chinese medicine. So I really had no major background in film, but I had always loved movie making. I always loved filmmaking and actors and movies and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I hit a point in my life when I was, you know, about 23 years old or so, and I'm like, okay, I think I have enough education here that I need to go and pursue what I really, really want to do. And so I just, you know, moved out to Los Angeles, started up in an acting class because I thought the only thing that you ever did in movies was act. I didn't know there were other positions on the film set. So I was pretty green when I came out and studied acting for about 5 years at the Playhouse West Repertory Theater and, you know, learned a lot of great things about it. I think the best thing about Playhouse West for me personally was they held a film festival every year. And they said, look, you know, you can make it here as an actor, but we also think that you should learn all the other things that happen on a movie set. So go out and start making some short films. So I ended up making a small production company with a bunch of friends that were in my acting class, and we started making a bunch of short films. And, you know, after about a year of just playing around, kind of understanding how stuff works, we shot everything on, you know, mini DV and everything when that DVX-100 came out. It was, you know, the special new camera, and just started playing around. And then finally we came to a point where we decided, you know, the little group I was with wanted to make a really, you know, a little bit bigger sort of thing. You know, we wanted to make a cool short film that was a Western period piece, and so we decided, hey, let's go shoot this thing in Santa Fe. We knew some people out there where we could have a location for free, you know, and all these productions were made, you know, on cheeseburgers and french fries. I mean, no one paid for anything, so,
right.
You know, it was very low budget, and, you know, this is actually when I ended up meeting Andy, you know, and so
mm-hmm.
The name of the production was called Back East, and we were shooting out in Santa Fe, and Andy was a pro in our eyes, you know, because he actually had some education in filmmaking and had, you know, gone to AFI and everything, and he was phenomenal, shot a beautiful movie for us on a no-budget sort of scale. And during that production, Andy and I started talking about what we wanted to do, you know, where we wanted to head, and we found that we had a lot of things in common. So we just started putting together some ideas. I started to learn that there's actually other things besides an actor on set, and began learning what it's like to direct, you know, and started putting some short films together until Andy and I decided, look, if we're actually going to make a run at any of this stuff, we got to put a feature together. And I think that's, you know, and that got us to making Stolen. So
yeah, just a couple of quick questions about
sure.
what you've just said, and then Andy, I want to ask you the same question. Your sensibilities, though, what films, what filmmakers, actors were you gravitating towards?
Wow. You know, I think filmmaker-wise, I think the first movie that really, really solidified to me that I wanted to be a director was watching The Following by Christopher Nolan. Learning about his story and how he had put that production together and seeing his sensibilities of understanding story as well as thriller, as well as camera, as well as working with actors, I think that you see it through his career, you know, I mean, going all the way now to making, which I love now, the new Batman franchise. I think he's just phenomenal being able to create something that's big budget yet has so much character going on in it and so much story. He just seems like such a master, and I think that was sort of, you know, the thing, you know, that I really gravitated towards and thought, you know, sensibility wise that's who I would really want to emulate myself after, is someone who could really pull all those things off. And I think that I really was happy with my acting background of sort of understanding what that was and what it was, what story meant from an acting perspective. And now it's really growing in a sense of what is storytelling from a director's perspective and a producer's perspective and all that sort of stuff, and being able to create really strong movies that mm-hmm. have an amazing hook to them, but it's not just about the hook, it's also about the character development and the acting and everything else that goes involved with it. And I think that's really my central point of what I'm really striving for and what I really want to achieve, you know,
yeah.
in the sense of a grand scale of my career.
Well, I want to definitely ask you about the kind of learning curve when you started directing. Andy, if you can give me a sense of that same theme, what movies inspired you growing up? What inspired you to become a filmmaker yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say background-wise, just like, you know, everyone I sort of, you talk to, you know, I loved movies as a kid, you know, as most people do, and watched them my whole life, and to the point where I even managed a video store when I was in high school. I was a total videophile, and I just tried to watch everything I could all the time, and I knew that I wanted to be in, somehow involved in movies. I just, you know, naively didn't know what any of that was. And ironically, you know, like Anders thought, everyone, all you ever did was you acted if you were in movies. That's all you ever did. I always thought the person behind the camera was the person that did everything. That was the only thing that seemed to really matter at the time. And when I just looked on, you know, when I was in college, I just looked and said, who is the person behind the camera? And it's, ah, it's a cameraman. Okay, well, I'll be a cinematographer then. Not knowing what a director was, not knowing anything else. I said, oh, that's what I want to do then. So I started doing film school, and I did film studies at UC Santa Barbara, which was really good. And then I moved on to AFI, and got a master's cinematography there, and just started shooting features, kind of right out of school. And for me, growing up, you know, I was inspired by so many movies, so many directors, so many cinematographers, composers, you know, from Ferris Bueller's Day Off to The Crow to Glory. You know, all those kind of movies really want, you know, when the character, a deep, dark character, is brought onto the big screen and you can kind of get behind them and feel for them, empathize with them, and be sucked into that world, all those movies, all those filmmakers, I just thought it was magic. And I just wanted to somehow be a part of that. And I never knew if I could be, you know, one of those people that could do that, you know. And once me and Anders met in Santa Fe, it felt like we had some sort of kinship where we both had that desire that we wanted to be those people that could be those artists that could bring that to other people. That, you know, we might have stories that we want to tell that are like the movies that we grew up watching, you know, that could really bring something to other people and to a mass audience. And that's what started us, you know, going after Stolen and trying to get the film made. So it's like we came from, in a sense, slightly different backgrounds on how we got to the same point, but we wanted to go in the exact same road.
Well, there are a lot of similarities between the two of you guys have just articulated. Tell me how this partnership works. Tell me how you challenge and inspire one another.
That's great. Do you want to take that, Andy?
Not sure. Yeah, I mean, it's all different ways. We work so closely, you know, all the time, for the point where we can finish each other's sentence sometimes or let the other speak. So, you know, we come from, again, it's a variation of when we completely agree on so many things to when we start talking about story and story concepts and what we're going to do. And if we disagree on something, it's almost as if we're battling ourselves or our inner selves going, well, why would I think that? So it's like if me and Anders we're thinking a different way, it is to me is thinking, well, why am I not thinking that way? And sometimes it's vice versa. So we just talk to each other about, you know, what are you thinking? Why do you think that? Why do we think that? And we just kind of come up with the best solution that we think it is, whether it's in terms of writing something, a shot, how something looks, performance, whatever it is. We just talk through pretty much everything because we know that, you know, coming from producing it to directing it to cinematography to cutting it, everything we did with the film, we worked together, you know, side by side. So we had to know the language and have the language with ourselves. And so, in a sense, we just talk through everything. And we so rarely, I don't even remember, man, if we even disagreed on anything. You know, if we disagreed, it was always like on a frame. You know, we got to the point where it's like, nah, one frame there. And we'd already, you know, we'd sit there and go, well, maybe another frame that way. That was pretty much it.
Yeah, I think that was an interesting point that Andy brought up is that, you know, we are sort of like, you know, two brains as one working towards something. And I think the biggest thing, and you know, if we ever do have a disagreement on something, it usually is just because, you know, we all know that we're trying to go with the story, and the real big thing is it's a great disagreement because it's the other argument of,
exactly,
you know, I thought about that, but that wasn't as strong as the one I have inside. I'm glad that you feel that you need to express that one because now I'm really starting to think about why did I think that, but I didn't really express it yet. Let's now talk about it because we both are not seeing eye to eye necessarily on this point. But we both have in our heads and in our minds basically going, yeah, I thought of that same scenario, so we need to definitely talk about this. And so it's almost a gauge of like, you know, we think of, you know, if Andy expresses his opinion, I kind of go, do I have the same opinion? Yeah, I do. If I don't, I go, well, I can see that opinion totally. I have this opinion. Let's talk it out and see if we can come up with the best solution. Because a lot of times it's a combination of the two, and it goes beyond what we each were thinking. And that's why I think is so great that of how we work together, because it's never something that's so differing that we can't come to some sort of conclusion. We actually know that most of the time when our opinion does differ, it's because we're actually both trying to combine something that makes it more special. We just need to talk about it to get that figured out.
Yeah, but we don't like to be idle. So when we start just throwing out ideas, and it's not that we disagree, it's just like, how do we get the best? It's always for us, is whatever the idea is, how do we get to the best we can, the best idea we can, the best performance we can, best anything we can get. And that's the challenge we're talking about. How do we challenge each other? That's what we do. We're always asking each other, how do we make it better than what we just thought of?
Right.
Yeah. So with Solon, Anders, how did you happen upon the script, and what about the script spoke to you in a way that made you want this to be your debut feature?
You know, we came upon Stolen in the sense of Andy had worked on a film for a production company called Code Entertainment, and they ended up as we were looking for scripts, we called everybody that we knew that we had any sort of affiliation with at all. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I'd call my grandma and say, "Do you have a script, Grandma?" Because I'm just like looking for material to do something. Because, you know, we had this unbelievable opportunity of knowing that this is what we wanted to do, and also had the looming sort of WGA strike that was coming up, going, well, if we don't get something off the ground soon, we may not be able to make a movie for 2 years, you know? And so there's this tremendous pressure on us to kind of like think, well, let's get something going now, because we just don't know what's going to happen with the industry. So we really pushed and pushed and pushed, and Andy knew of some people over at Code, because he had worked on a film with them before, and knew that they had a writing management company. And we said, cool, let's just, you know, see if they can send us something over. And they sent us a couple scripts. We ended up reading a script called Boy in the Box by Glenn Taranto, which ended up becoming Stolen. I think it was one of those things where, you know, you read so much material, and, you know, although the ideas are good, you're looking for something that's fresh, something that's new, and something that you think will help at least make a difference, especially on your debut, which is a very, you know, obviously a very important first step. And so by looking at, you know, the first 10 pages of the script, where you see this horrible event happen of a father who ends up losing his son at a fair, that, first of all, struck me in just as a chord of just, you know, as a person just going, this is an awful event that really, you know, has already had me interested in what's going to happen and how are we going to know, you know, what is the story going to be about. And then, you know, stepping back also artistically, when you look at it and you see the difference of these two time periods, and that you have these two leads that you're really dealing with and the emotions that are with it. So you're really dealing with, you know, which I think was difficult in a sense as a first-time director. You're dealing with not only a drama, but you're also dealing with a genre sort of, you know, mystery thriller kind of going on. And to try and play with those two sensibilities came right back to the feeling of what I had when I would watch a movie like The Following or whatnot, of the people that I really, you know, admired. And I saw this and was like, okay, wait, this is not only just a thriller. This is also a very strong acting piece that we could get two really great actors, and how phenomenal would that be? And it turned out to be that way. And Andy and I kind of, you know, guessed right, and it was great. And I learned a lot through that film because of having to juggle a true drama with also the mystery thriller elements that have to be in there to keep the story moving. And I think it was a great challenge, and I learned a lot from it. So.
In putting it together, you mentioned the impending strikes and so forth and having to deal with that pressure. But I read that you put together a visual montage to kind of sell it to the actors.
Describe what
that was.
Yeah, sure, go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, since we knew that no one knew who we were, and it was our first film out, that we knew we had to test to not just, you know, possible investors, but all to anyone who wanted to join the movie, any actors that we wanted to go out to. And for us, when we heard this possibility that Josh, we could get something to Josh, the script, we sat down and we said, we need to be able to give something to people to show what we want the movie to be, you know, to show who we are. And so we just sat down and we pulled DVDs from the shelf and just started ripping them and coming up with scenes that we really felt that portrayed the style of the film. And it's not just the style, but with the mood of the movie and where we wanted to go with the movie, in a sense, what we wanted the movie to be. You know, after we worked so hard, this is where we wanted the movie to go. And so we pulled clips, we pulled music from soundtracks, paintings, pictures, and, you know, in a sense, at that point, we were still learning Final Cut Pro because neither of us really knew it well, and just taught ourselves how to do it and put this QuickTime movie, you know, about 2.5 minutes, and, you know, at that, you know, I know we still have it. At the time it was done, we were quite proud of it because we thought, oh, this really does tell the shows what we want to do with this movie.
Right.
And it certainly was a great selling piece because, you know, when we first were lucky enough to have the first conversation with Josh, he brought it up, absolutely. He said that he loved it. It really helped, you know, him know where we were coming from, and it really began this first stage of communication to everyone that about where we wanted the movie to go, and it helped us in the very beginning figure out the style that we wanted. So we could communicate to ourselves exactly like, no, this is the look we want, this is the style we want, this is the pace we want. And it just solidified a lot of things. And it was a great, great method. And, you know, we're going to bring that same method in any, you know, in all aspects to the future projects that we do, just because it worked so well.
And I think the really great thing, too, is, you know, the hard thing of, you know, especially when you're like a first-time director in this industry, it's basically everyone's thinking, well, what gives you the right to think you can even go and make a feature film? You know, and it's tough to take that every single day when you're saying, oh, I think that we should do this, I think we should do that. And you know, in dealing with, you know, people who are going to be working on your movie, they basically are feeling like, well, what can you show me to show me that you can do this? And my honest answer was, I haven't done this, so I can't show you anything. But I have put together, you know, Andy and I have put together this montage piece that tells you what we believe the movie will be, and we are doing everything we can to get this movie off the ground. You're just going to have to follow us. And the great thing is, you know, someone like Josh coming on board, Josh Lucas, it also helped us, you know, have some sort of clout. It gave us some sort of validity, which was really phenomenal because we were battling validity the whole movie, you know, with in a sense, not with the actors, but really with the production side and the business side of making a movie. It, you know, it's just harsh out there. And so you have to try and do everything you can, fight and scratch, because everyone just thinks, no, I know how to make a movie better than you because you're a first-timer. And so we had to continually prove we can do this thing. We know what we're doing. So that was really instrumental.
So you secured Josh's participation. With John Hamm, was this prior to Mad Men kind of hitting the zeitgeist?
Oh, yeah. It was at that precipice, I guess. You know, it was at the point where he had just finished his first season with Mad Men. And our casting director, Stephanie Corsellini, she was basically saying, you've got to meet John Hamm. I found your guy. This guy is going to be perfect against Josh. He's going to be able to hold himself up, you know, against Josh Lucas. And we're like, cool. You know, we Andy and I sat down, watched, you know, an episode or two of Mad Men because there weren't, you know, wasn't much of it out yet. And when we met him at Starbucks, literally, you know, a week before, you know, shooting in a sense, he was just the epitome of exactly what we were looking for the Tom Atkins character. I mean, he embraced it. He was, you know, all involved in it. He was alive as a person. I mean, just strong in his sensibilities. And he brought a lot of thought just to the conversation of us saying hello and, you know, is he interested in doing the movie? And he was absolutely phenomenal. And then, you know, when he showed up on set too, he brought everything that we needed, and it was absolutely fantastic for us to work with him at that point because since then he's just exploded so much that, you know, it's
you got lightning in a bottle.
Oh, man,
yeah.
That's great.
But without a doubt, I mean, sitting there and talking to him, it was somewhat surreal because we had gone through so many casting sessions for other characters. So then we met John. He's such a lively character and such an amazing guy that, you know, I got caught back and forth between just watching him talk and imagining him being the character, even though we're just having a conversation and going, no, I'm just having a conversation with this person. At least introduce, and I'm like, I had to tell myself, introduce myself nicer, better, because I'm just talking to him. But as a producer, I was watching, going, oh, this is the guy. And I was going back and forth because it was such a great conversation. He just had so much energy in that meeting that you just knew automatically he was the guy, without a doubt.
He has so much charisma that it just blows you away, and it shows on camera, I think, and that's the amazing thing about John, you know, that we knew he could match Josh's intensity and stuff.
Yeah. Everyone's great in the film, and James Vanderbeek is very kind of surprising and a very, very strong performance in this film.
Yeah.
Tell me about the first day. What kind of experience did you have? How were the nerves?
Sure.
How did you get out of the gate? So
sure, I'll go first.
Yeah, you jump on that one.
Andy's much more of a if either one of us is more of a seasoned pro, it'd definitely be Andy. So first day, we're shooting in Old Town Orange, which is like, it's already a long haul to get down there anyway, which is, it's kind of like for movie people, it's at the very edge of the 30-mile zone sort of thing where people are not really happy to be there anyway because you have to drive so far through traffic and all that sort of stuff, not getting really paid that much to be on this movie. And thank God, again, Josh is there. And the great thing about the first day is it's Old Town Orange, Josh Lucas, Jimmy Bennett. I'm like, okay, cool. We got our two main characters here. They're both pros. They're fantastic. And Jimmy plays the younger boy, Matthew Wakefield. And so I'm nervous as hell, obviously. I'm sitting here going, our pre-production was so quick that I didn't even know if we even knew, what was, in a sense, going on and if we had locations secured for the next day and if the actors were already cast for the following day because we were casting through the entire movie. I mean, it was so fast that – I just was hoping that I was going to be able to hold on for the ride and not fall off. And mm-hmm. So I think one of the greatest things was, we get set up and we're ready to go. Andy's, calm, cool, and collected as he is, with that's just the way that he is. And so I'm sitting here like a nervous wreck trying to be cool, sit down at the chair, look at the monitor. I'm like, okay, I know not to screw this up. I just need to call action. So let's just call action, so we go through and I call action. I hear Josh's voice in my headphones and I'm thinking, who's directing this movie? Oh my God, this guy is absolutely amazing. His voice is resonating in my ears, like honey. I'm like, this is phenomenal. I relaxed in that moment and I was like, oh my gosh, we have a movie. And I'm thinking, okay. And from there, I'm like, all right, dude, don't be a nerd. Put your head together. Let's do this. This is going to be great. And it ended up being a really phenomenal day. We got everything we needed, and everybody was supportive, and the film was great from there on in. I mean, we had problems like any other movie, but we had great actors that every time I just put on the headphones, look at the monitor, and go, thank God.
So, they are great actors, but yeah. From a directing standpoint,
yeah.
When you spoke to them or gave them direction, did they have different needs? Did you find that you approached them differently?
They were all different on how they approached it. And I think the one thing about, like, having an acting background, or at least, I was a bad actor, but I at least knew what acting was about. I was relaxed enough to know, look, if there doesn't need to really be any adjustment, then just walk up to them and say, hey, good job. Let's go again, sort of thing.
Right.
Because these guys brought so much to the table that the last thing I wanted to do was get in their heads, and so I really just try to respect them as actors and stay out of their heads, unless something was really going awry. And I tell you what, it did with our main characters, it never did. They brought so much to the table that it was really once in a while it'd be like a this or that, or maybe a head turn, or keep looking at the camera a little bit more, sort of thing, or that sort of thing. But it was never a performance issue because they would, if there was a question, they would ask me. And it was an extremely simple way to answer them. I could just, kind of answer them the way if I was an audience member, by saying, oh, yeah, I really just saw this as you being really intense. And they go, okay, cool. And they do it, and I'm like, whoa, that was intense.
Yeah, and it seemed they brought it, like Andrew said, so many different variations, so many different ways, mm-hmm. that the best thing for us to have done was, like, get out of the way. And what I think they wanted and what worked for us is that we were from the perspective of the viewer watching it on the monitor, listening to the, listening to the buzz and going, okay, this is what it sounds like. So all we had to do is come back and go, this is the best way for us to get a little more out of what you're giving.
Yeah.
So it's more of a technical thing, and just let them do what they do best.
Yeah.
And it worked really well because they're so great. They're all so great.
And the other thing too is, I'm sorry, just really quick, because I know the other major thing for us was there wasn't much time to give much direction anyway, because there was 2 to 3 takes literally at the most. I mean, sometimes it was you get one shot to do this and then you have to move on. And I was like, I get one take. If the actor gets one take, this is crazy. So that helps in a sense, from the get-go when everyone knew that they had to bring it on the first take. And so by doing that, there wasn't much direction to give because they would just go, this is what I'm doing. And I was like, that's exactly what I was hoping, you know. And so it was very fortunate. But, you know, we were so limited on takes, it was really tough on the actors, and they just brought it every time. Literally, it was 2 to 3 takes, and that's it. So Andy,
you, yes. In addition to working as a producer on this project, you also were the DP.
Yes.
And we alluded to this earlier, the different time periods that – or excuse me. I'll edit that cough out. the different time periods that are represented in the film. Tell me from a visual standpoint, can you articulate how you achieved that?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that, you know, Anders and I had talked about from the very beginning, especially in our visual montage, you know, going over movies like the difference between something that looked like Road to Perdition versus The Natural, and, you know, just all these high-end movies that could emulate a time period with an emotion. And how do you do that as a filmmaker? And so we just sat down and started talking about color, what things looked like, and, you know, the things that we knew that we could have basic control over was lenses and film stock, color, and, you know, and angles. And that was basically the only thing you could really control, knowing that the pace that we had to deal with. And so we just chose, you know, a certain particular film stock and knew, you know, some filters that would work for the period piece and something that would contrast what's going on with 2008. So we definitely wanted didn't want the stereotypical feeling of the past, you know, didn't want to be black and white or anything like that. So we just come up with like a nice saturated gold kind of hue that me and Anders felt would really tell 1958 in contrast to, you know, the tones and the coolness and the tension of 2008. And then we would just compare that to, you know, angles and, you know, lens choices that we were making. So we were very specific on, you know, we were definitely wide on the lenses for 1958, and a lot tighter and a little shakier for 2008. And we really tried to think of them as truly two different time periods and almost two different styles on how to shoot the movie. Mm-hmm. And it was very important to us to the transitions between the two was a great way, a segue for the audience to feel connected between those two different types of movies. And so when the movie is done, they felt both stories and they experienced both stories, even though they're visually very different. And that's something we worked really, really hard on. And that was, you know, that's where we spend a lot of our energy on, because we're on set. We just didn't have as much, like Anders said, 2 or 3 takes. And, you know, it's also very little time to set up the shots.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, everything that we could think about before the day and then how we had to evolve and change compared to, you know, all the stuff you have to go through to make this type of movie. So we just stuck with the visual language that we set up earlier of the few things that we control, and we just ran with it like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know, because this has been such an intensive process for you both, I want to hear from you both, what, after all of this, have you learned about your film from watching it with an audience?
Great. Go for it, Andy. I have my own.
Yeah, we both have her. The biggest thing I learned is that when we trust, you know, and I believe this for both of us, we trusted our gut. We tend to be right in your first instinct of things that you love, things that you don't love, and what's important about just generic storytelling. And that no matter what the frills or anything we do in any type of movie making, storytelling, that it really comes down to the essence of the story, you know, and the characters within that story. And that's the most important thing. And it's not that we've forgotten about that by any standpoint. I'm proud of how we did it. It's just, it's always a nice reminder when you watch it with audiences, because they don't care about a frame here or a frame there or how hard it took to get that one shot. They just are interested, intrigued in watching the actors and getting the sense of the story that we're presenting them. And although I thought that before going into the shoot, it was solidified throughout the whole entire process, you know, now when I can watch the film with an audience. And I know, and it cements in what is important about being a filmmaker and presenting a story to an audience.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what I really got out of it, you know, besides the fact that you need to really, you know, it's so hard, you bounce between, you know, will the audience get this, will the audience not get this? And you know, as producers, you look at it and you see it so many times that you start to forget, you know, do I understand this if I watch this as the first time of making this or of watching this movie? And I think, that what you realize is that audiences are intelligent, you know, and they do get what's going on. And they really relate, and the most important thing I found was they just relate on an emotional level, you know,
yeah.
And that's the biggest thing that, you know, when there are parts when I go, wow, you know, I usually equivalate, you know, it to energy, you know, because energy to me means emotion. So when the energy of the movie, in a sense, in certain parts, might start to fade a little bit, I go, oh, there's that moment where, thank God, there's enough, you know, emotion that's going on that keeps that energy going. And so I think it's really understanding, and I know that the next projects that Andy and I both will approach will always be on the aspect of how do we get the highest energy out of this scene or out of this performance while at the same time staying true to whatever the emotion is. And that's something that I really learned, because it's more than just, hey, that's a really cool shot, or that's a really cool angle, or wow, look how smart I'm being as a director with, you know, this sort of blocking that I put together. It's way more than that. It's really about the energy that is infused into the film, and I know that I will be much more conscious about that the next time I go to make a movie, because this one was really about, my God, can I survive this? Okay, let's get this, let's do this, let's put this in the can. And the great thing was, I was very fortunate to have actors that brought the energy, but that might not always be the case. So I've got to
right.
make sure that as a director, I make sure that the energy is always at the level of where I want it to be. And I know that that's what I definitely will bring to the rest of the work that I do.
Okay, that's director Anders Andersen and co-producer and director of photography Andy Steinman from the new movie Stolen. It's available on video on demand systems, and it's opened up in New York and LA. Stars Josh Lucas and John Hamm. It's a good movie.
You recommend that we watch it on demand if we have access to that? It's worthwhile?
Yes.
All right, sounds good to me. I have to watch The Pacific and Breaking Bad tonight, so I probably won't.
Oh, The Pacific. I caught that last week. Our buddy Chris is on the phone. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Howdy, guys. What's going on?
Howdy ho.
Heidi ho.
Have you been?
Okay,
you don't
I'll
get
see you.
Me.
Okay, wait a second. Well,
okay, bye bye.
What was that last transmission by Chris? Wait, what was that?
I was just signing off.
Oh,
what's
okay,
going
wow.
on?
Wow, that was quick. Okay.
Yeah. What, you don't get HBO, do you, Chris?
I do not. I do not.
Oh, so you haven't been able to see The Pacific?
No, I'm actually not interested.
that's interesting that he brings that up. I'm gonna ask the big question here. Have you all watched Band of Brothers?
Yeah,
I'm just curious what you thought of that. What you guys thought?
I thought it was very good. I do really feel like World War II is completely fucked out. Like, just completely fucked out. Like, I mean, I have no doubt that the Pacific is a really good program, but it's just one of those things where it's just another endeavor that I don't really, I don't know, I feel like I don't have the time for it.
Well, I understand it, Chris, and I appreciate your honesty on the subject, because I got to be honest with you, I've seen most of Band of Brothers, not all of it, but I have to say, while that was going on, I think it was after the first weekend, we were attacked the Tuesday after
yeah.
that. I lost
yeah, it was right around that time.
Yeah, I lost interest considerably in the
yeah.
show, so I only would come back to it sporadically. I think the big thing is that Tom Hanks needs to once again send out a memo that he was not in World War II. I
yeah.
really do. I like the show last week, don't get me wrong, but I agree with you. There is some sort of, it's almost pornography at this point.
It really is. Like, the obsession with World War II is just, I mean, it's over the top, and like I said, I'm sure it's a really good project,
yeah.
and by all accounts it is. I just am less and less interested in seeing it. It's just one of those types of movies that I feel like we've seen, we
mm-hmm.
really have touched on just about every angle. And strangely, like, Inglourious Basterds falls into that category too, but that really is the first, like, original World War II project in quite some time, actually.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Tarantino, I didn't want the Jews to be the victims this time.
Yeah.
It's got to hand it to them.
Anyway, I saw it. I thought it was fine. You know who directed it was that Tim Van Patten, the episode last week, the Sopranos
yeah.
veteran.
He's one
Sopranos
of the,
guy.
One of the Van Patten Offspring, right? The guy from Angels in Africa.
Well, I think that's safe to say. I don't know.
No, but you know, I mean, this guy from Eight is Enough and various Mel
right.
movies and everything. No, because
he's from the Van Patten family.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And they used to do those Oldsmobile ads or one of the cars ads in like the 70s and 80s. But okay, never mind. I've just revealed my age all too much.
Well, you know, every week we like to play a little game on the show called the Mystery Movie Score of the Week. It's a great segue. And, Jerry, do you remember what the Mystery Movie Score was last show?
Dude, I don't even remember what I was doing this morning. How can I remember? How can I remember? I honestly don't remember. I remember it was kind of eerie, though, from, you know, so
mm-hmm.
I don't really, you know, but...
Well, it's playing now. Let's,
I know
let's
it's playing now.
Get a little taste and see if Chris comes up with anything.
I think Chris
should be obvious in a few moments. These are the sounds in my house at all hours of the night.
Oh, you have those dreams too?
Yeah.
It's not the soundtrack to Knowing. I thought it was Rosemary's Baby, wasn't it? Or...
No.
Oh, was it? No, because I remember we were talking about this. Oh,
Chris. Yes. It's Poltergeist.
Oh.
All right. So what will the Mystery Movie Score be this week? Tune in to the end of the show to find out.
Yeah, really. Stay with us, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you can survive this, if you can survive the Cotton Club, you can survive anything.
The weekend box office, Alice in Wonderland on top again. Really close to 300 mil, I guess.
Yeah, well, we kind of knew that was going to happen. There was nothing coming out that was going to really give it a run for its money between Diary of a Wimpy Kid and the Jennifer Aniston movie. Not a big
what
shock.
What is it about the Jennifer Aniston movie? Like, the press was really coming down on it. Like, everyone was making fun of the fact it couldn't beat the Wimpy Kid movie. And it just, first of all, Gerard Butler, it's really ironic that Gerard Butler comes out with a movie the same day as Jude Law had the same problem as Mr. Butler a couple of years ago. He's in every movie that comes out these days. As Jude Law.
Well, The Bounty Hunter didn't do terribly. I mean,
it didn't do terribly, but it's just basically tied.
I mean,
Butler was very good in a movie called Dear Frankie, and, you know, obviously 300, but he just seems to be in everything lately. I know you have to take advantage. You got to take what comes to you because it's not always going to come to you.
Well, I didn't know what the hell this Wimpy Kid thing was, and then I went to the theater the other day, and there was a line for it in the theater. Diary of a Wimpy Kid? Somebody find my memoirs?
Yeah. Young adults, you know, young or children. It's a popular kids book that.
I did see The Ghost Writer,
mm-hmm.
the new Polanski movie. And in true Chris Jamie fashion, I called Chris a half hour before I saw it and invited him.
A half hour before is actually quite a lot of time when you consider how we usually go to the movies.
Yeah, I'm standing in the ticket line right now. Would you like to go meet me? So anyway, I saw the new Polanski movie. You didn't see it, right, Chris?
No, I've not seen it.
You mean after that, all that, you didn't go?
I left a message.
I was at Busch Gardens when you called.
It's the one movie I would say you really should go see.
I have every intention of going to see it. Of course, it just started.
I'm glad it's open where you guys are, because it's not a wide release yet at all. So
it just started.
Yeah, it shocked me that it did play here, because it's in 224 theaters.
That's right.
Meanwhile, something like The Runaways is in 254, and it's nowhere around here.
Well, that's
so
not,
odd.
That's got a wide release April 9th, I think.
Yeah, it does. So anyway, The Ghost Writer. Ghost Writers in the Sky. What did you think of it, Jerry?
It's easily Polanski's best film since Chinatown, without a
really?
Doubt.
Really?
Oh, yeah. This is
better than Pirates.
Well, yeah, I mean, so is Chasing Lane Saves the World is better than Pirates, so never mind. But Pirates is, I'm not saying, I think The Pianist is a really good film. I think that's his most personal film. but I'm beginning to think that The Ghost Rider maybe is his most personal film, because not only is he basically, he obviously identifies with both characters in this film. He identifies with Lang, and he identifies with the ghost. He identifies with them very strongly. But he's, while he identifies with them, he's having fun with us, and he's fucking with us on a massive level. He is basically saying, you know, this is what you think you know about me? No, you don't know, but I'm going to have fun with you. I'm going to fuck with your brain so much that by the end of this movie, you will either think less of me or more of me. And I think he really identified with Robert Harris's book, and he wanted to work with Robert Harris before on Robert Harris's Pompeii, but I think this was the better fit.
Yeah.
Who knew that Tony Blair, a novel that is basically is an indictment of Tony Blair's life, would be the perfect Polanski vehicle?
Yeah, it does definitely have that sense of duality, and it has the elements that are typical great Polanski. I just thought it was a great story.
It's an incredible story.
Yeah, really well told.
Guessing at to the very end, I didn't guess that would be the final image of the film. I'm not giving anything away, but I like Shutter Island and everything. This makes Shutter Island look like Sesame Street. Masterful film on every level. We should be so lucky that in our old age that we can do something this magnificent, this brilliant.
Yeah. I liked it a lot. I loved the performances. I thought Pierce Brosnan was great. I thought he was great at just very subtly playing a complete boob. You know, he's not completely bright. You know, and I really liked Ewan McGregor. And if you think about the task that Ewan McGregor had, he is in every frame of this movie.
Yeah.
He is our entrance into this movie. He is the voyeur for us. And there's not a scene that he's not in. So I thought he was great. Olivia Williams was great. So it's performance-wise, it's a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Visually, it's spectacular. And the ending, I know that there's some contention about the ending because I've heard in different critical circles. I thought the ending was the most Polanski thing about it.
Yeah.
Right down to the fact that the final incident happens off camera. And that is a spectacular closing shot. And the shot prior to it with the papers and then the passing of the paper was just thrilling. You're thrilled by the passing of a piece of paper down an auditorium. So I thought it was very good. And it did pretty well performance-wise.
Oh, it did pretty well. I just wish it would get a wider release. It deserves a wider release. I know the you know, there's some articles that come out saying that people won't go see it because of Polanski's name, and I have to say, really, that's bullshit on that. People don't care about that. They want to see a good movie, they're going to see a good movie. And this is as good as it's going to get. I would actually put this against most films that came out last year, and I hope that this film will be recognized at Oscar time, which it probably won't be. But this is Polanski at really the top of his game in a very long time.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
I don't think that anybody's going to care if Polanski or even realize that Polanski directed it or know what the heck that is.
People don't
somebody directs a movie if it's like Spielberg's name, the masses.
Yeah, people don't really care about that kind of stuff outside of like, you know, the film bloggers or the movie geeks. People really don't care about that kind of thing. Do you honestly think Joe Sixpack really cares if Polanski's directing a film? He doesn't care.
Yeah.
He's, oh, this film looks really good. It's a good thriller maybe. All right, I'll go check this out. You know, most decisions at the box office are made when people arrive to the theater, and they're like, "What can I go see?"
Yeah.
That's
also,
really
Tom Wilkinson has a very good creepy scene in it.
I didn't even want to really mention him because his part is so spectacular and everything.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's just amazing.
And you see, like in one scene or two scenes at most, these great like faces, like James Belushi with a shaved head, and Timothy Hutton,
mm-hmm.
Eli Wallach, man. Yeah, great stuff.
Yeah.
And really, the setting and the rainy, like, representation of Martha's Vineyard and the gray, overcast look of the film, it's
mm-hmm.
fantastic. Chris, have you seen any? I've seen some other movies too. I'd like to talk about. But Chris, have you seen anything of note lately?
I've not been to the movies. It's really dead season right now for movies. I'm catching up on some stuff at home. Saw The Informant. Liked it very much. But I wasn't blown away by it or anything. I just thought it was not good, solid work from Soderbergh and Matt Damon. So
yeah.
I did see a movie that surprised me quite a bit, mostly not because I had low expectations of it, but because so many people had shat upon it for so long. I saw Richard Kelly's The Box. And
see, you know, that's why I love Chris, because he comes through for me when I least expect it.
I was blown away by how much I enjoyed that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was an extremely fun and enjoyable from beginning frame to ending frame. It does fly off the rails a little bit. I mean, it gets a little bit crazy, but that's who the director is, and I thought the movie did a good enough job of setting the mood so that you were almost anticipating that this was going to be really fucking crazy from the time it gets on. I really enjoyed it in an exactly a Twilight Zone, Outer Limits kind of way. I thought it was the closest thing to those old Twilight Zones since those old Twilight Zones. I mean,
yeah.
They've tried to do the movie, and they tried to remake the show, and they tried the new Outer Limits show, and it's never worked quite as creepy as those old shows were. I thought this had that kind of weird, sadistic creepiness to it that those old Twilight Zone shows did. And I loved it. I really did.
Well, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, good, good.
Chris, I've ruined my name defending him and that movie. I'm nothing now. You must realize that my name is mud.
Well, I'm not a defender of Richard Kelly. I mean, I think he's talented, but I was never insane crazy about Donnie Darko when a lot of people were. I thought it was decent, but I wasn't blown away.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise with Southland Tales.
Right.
In fact, I thought that one was just straight up bad. But this was really, and I thought genuinely creepy too. Really, really sustained a lot of horror throughout the entire movie.
That's true.
You see De Palma in it, Chris?
De Palma. When was De Palma in it?
No. Meant 50 Shades of De Palma. Wait.
The guy in the safari jacket? You didn't see him?
You didn't see.
No, I thought that's what you were saying, that he had some sort of cameo. I can see that a little bit. I can see the influence of De Palma, but I don't know. Like, there wasn't a boring second in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
There really wasn't. Like, there wasn't ever a time when it had a lull. I mean, like I said, there's a period in the movie where it goes off, way off the tracks, and it's fucking out there. But at no point does it feel lazy, or does it feel like something that was just, we've seen this one before. It doesn't feel like that ever. So I like that.
The thing I liked most about it was the visual. It really looked like a throwback to great 70s kind of thrillers, and the lighting and the harsh lighting and the soft focus and
right.
that kind of stuff. The performances just didn't do it for me.
Yeah,
I don't think
the performance
Cameron Diaz has ever been better, to be honest with you.
I thought she's never been worse.
No, I think she needs to go dark more often. I mean, this is obviously her strong point. She really does need to go dark more often.
That kind of material needs performances like that. It needs performances from, you know, of course, like one of the most famous Twilight Zone episodes is the Terror at 20,000 Feet or whatever, and who's the actor in that? It's William Shatner, the hammiest actor there is, and I think that is one of the most famous episodes for a reason, because that kind of storytelling needs a really hammy actor. I mean, it's meant to be. It reminded me a lot, actually, in a way of.
It'd be great if they actually pitched it to James Marsden. We need a really heavy actor.
But look, he's really good in that. I mean, you can't argue with his performance. I mean, it's really,
he is, and that would probably offend him as an actor to say we need a really hammy. But that's exactly the kind of actor he is. He's a really hammy actor. I mean, think about his scene in the third X-Men movie when he's crying about Jean Grey or whatever. It's just so over the top. It's wrong in that movie. It's perfect in The Box.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it works perfectly.
Well, I thought
the same with Cameron Diaz.
I thought he was crying because Bryan Singer wasn't directing it. That's why I thought he was crying in that. I mean, I didn't think he was crying.
Bryan Singer is directing the fourth one. The fourth,
is it
fifth
one?
One
or
fifth
is it
one?
X-Men
fourth.
First Class, or is it going to be the fourth film?
Oh,
it's
well,
another X-Men.
Wolverine movie. It's another X-Men movie.
It's another X-Men. There's so many of these Marvel films floating around right now. I mean, it's hard to keep up.
And how many good ones? How many good ones?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have no idea, okay?
I don't like this. I hate this move on Bryan Singer's part. This guy started off, he's just one of the most promising. I consider this career move to be on the level of M. Night Shyamalan or what it felt like the territory Quentin Tarantino was moving in. I mean, Bryan Singer was one of those guys, when he came on the scene with Usual Suspects, it was like, holy shit, who the hell is this? What's going on here? And then he made, you know, At Pupil. He made a couple interesting movies, the first two X-Men movies, and then he went off and made the Superman movie. Now he's back to the X-Men movie. Can't we make some movies for adults, please? Do we need to make the movies with the people with the superpowers and, you know, flying around and fighting demons and all this kind of shit? Like, wasn't Usual Suspects the greatest thing he's ever done? Like, am I fucking alone here?
No, it is. It is the greatest thing he's ever done. I don't know if he wants to go back. That's the problem, though. I don't know. And I like App Pupil, too. I like that film quite a lot. I like the first two X-Men film, and then he really wanted to do Superman. The problem with Superman is it feels more like a Richard Donner film than a Bryan Singer film. All too much like that. And then he does Valkyrie, which, you know, you could take or leave, and he wants to come back to X-Men. I think this is a problem to come back. Whenever a director comes back to something that made, you know, that they're very good at, but they've been away from for a while, and it seems like a desperate attempt almost to reclaim some kind of currency, it doesn't work out.
I mean, can you really make the argument, though, that he was very good at it? Like,
yes,
I mean, I can see someone making that argument for, like, Martin Scorsese with the gangster picture or something like that. But Bryan Singer, he made two comic book, which actually he's made three comic book movies. One of them sucked ass, and two of them were decent. So, like,
film before that for the longest time? And, I mean, you could say Blade, but I think what he did with X-Men was pretty extraordinary, because I got to say, from the trailer for the first X-Men film, I thought it looked awful. I saw it, I was blown away. The second one, even better. I didn't have high hopes for these films, but I think to bring in someone like him, he represents a new wave of comic book adaptations. Now, that's fine. That worked very well there. I think for him to come back after all that and, you know, what he's been through, I would much rather see an original film like The Usual Suspects or Public Access than another X-Men film. I just think the last two X-Men films have been mediocre to horrible. And I just rather see something else.
We're really scraping the barrel here.
Oh,
with
yeah,
comic
I mean,
book movies. Like, I'm surprised that it's still going on. Like, I mean, it's got to stop sometime, doesn't it? I mean, it's weird because comic books have been around since the 60s, and they've been popular since the 60s. I mean, really, really popular. That's when they started becoming extremely popular. I mean, they were around since the
30s.
Well,
I thought it was from the 30s, Chris. Really, it's
No, but comic books, Marvel comics, as we know.
Oh, Marvel,
them,
yeah.
You know, these characters, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Thor, all these guys, have been around since the 60s. And you can
make that about
Superman, too. So they've been popular all the time. We didn't really see any superhero movies up until about 10 years ago, and now it's just like the end of it. Like, are we going to go back to a period where we don't have a new Superman movie or a new superhero movie coming out every couple months? I really hope so, because it's choking out all the other good cinema, I feel like.
Not anytime soon. I mean, with Superman even coming back again and another Batman and Captain America just being cast today and or this weekend.
No, and like you guys are talking about the Ghost Rider earlier and like, oh, I hope it gets a wider release. Really? Why the fuck do you care? Like, nobody's going to see it. Like, they don't care. They want to see a Captain America movie or a Thor movie or whatever. You know, I mean, like, you could give the biggest marketing blitz in the world to Ghost Rider, and I haven't seen it, but I guarantee it's a good movie. People just aren't interested in that anymore, you know. I mean, they want to see, they want to see someone fly around and kill a bad
guy. I agree, but
like,
just for the health of the health of returning the investment on the movie, it did really well in 200 some on screens this weekend, and I'm sure it's a platform release that'll widen in the weeks ahead. I don't care if it's a $100 million grosser. I just would like to it to be in more markets because it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's a,
I would too. I'm not making the argument that you're wrong for wanting that. I'm just making the larger point that I think it's a moot point.
I know what you mean. Speaking of comic book superheroes,
I think Greenberg deserves a 3,000 theater release just because I identify with the movie wholeheartedly, but it's not going to get that. Okay, so.
Yeah. Speaking of comic book superheroes, that's one kind of role that it's doubtful that Gabore Sabide will ever play. The controversy about her this past week, since the Oscars actually, which was articulated first by Howard Stern and then picked up by the media, is what career does Sabide have any hopes of sustaining beyond her debut Precious High?
I made this argument on the show months ago.
Well, I think Howard Stern stole it from you.
We stole it from all of us.
Made this argument on the show.
Right, let's continue this for just a few moments. What can she realistically play?
There's no answers. No one's answering for a reason. Literally. I haven't heard this scuttlebutt about Howard Stern or any of this stuff, but literally, I hope one of you remembers me making this argument on the show a couple months ago.
Oh, I do, Chris. I remember that. That's why I'm keeping my mouth shut.
And I think I was right, and I think Howard Stern is right. Unfortunately, I mean, that's too bad because she did a really good job in the movie, and anyone who's seen her in an interview knows that it really was a great performance because she's not like that character Precious at all.
Right.
So. That's really, really, that's really an interesting question because I think it's true. It being the way that the system's set up, the way that people respond to stories these days, I don't think she does have much of a chance. I mean, we'll see her again. We'll see her in other parts, but we're never going to see her again in a part like that. We're never going to see her in a major supporting part. I highly doubt it. We'll just see her face here and there.
You don't think she's going to be in a Sex and the City sequel anytime soon?
Like Jennifer Hudson was.
Which one is she going to be?
I bring that up because someone else at Salon brought that up.
She going to be the one having sex, or is she going to be the city?
Oh, dude, I don't want to. That's cold. I can't condone that. No, but let me ask you this, though. All right, she is incredible in this film. She's incredible in this film. And what if she is really good on the show on Showtime with Laura Linney? Don't you think that there is I want to be optimistic here because, look, Precious, I don't think is the greatest film ever made, but I think it's a good film. And I think she deserves a shot. She put herself out there, and I have problems with the film mainly from some of the comments that Oprah made when she talked about the film. Actually, if you want to be very honest, I think Oprah opens herself up to an avenue of attack here she probably didn't expect. But I do think that her performance is very good, and she did win an Indie Spirit Award for it. I do think down the line there are roles for her, depending, who's going to write the scripts that are going to be there. But I think she could have a future there. I want to be optimistic. I want to give her the benefit of the doubt because we don't want to just say that she doesn't have a future. I don't want to get I like Howard Stern. I think he's very funny. And there is a lot of truth in what he says, but I would like him to be wrong. In a perfect world,
I would too. But the parts really the parts. If you're that kind of plus sized, they have to be very specific.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
Jamie, you're absolutely right, and Chris was right too when he brought this up back in November.
You don't even have to think about the future to look for a part for her. Think about the past.
Yeah.
Think about her and go back through the history of filmmaking as we know it, every movie that's ever been made in every country, and think what part could she have played, what part could she have been cast in. It's a very slim gathering of parts. In fact, none of them even rush to my mind.
Jerry, could you?
All of a sudden,
you're right. You're right, Chris. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's a sad thing.
Jerry, can I ask you a favor?
Oh, shit.
Could you change to your cell phone real quick?
Yeah, sure, I'll do that. Yeah,
because you're clicking.
I'm
sorry.
Too much. Sorry.
here's another. I want to talk about two topics specifically. one's not really a topic, but for much discussion. There's another remake on the horizon. And
shocking.
This one, yeah, this one will star J-Lo. So it's already smacking of quality. The movie is Overboard, the Gary Marshall movie.
Yeah,
I'm fine with this.
Yeah, I'm fine with it in the way that I'm fine with a lot of the remakes. I mean, that's not a sacred movie. You know, the only thing I ask is that they update it in a witty way, like bring some new witty banter to it. You know, like that was what was so cute and clever about the movie to begin with, was the witty banter between those two. I mean, the story itself is just your basic mistaken identity kind of thing. You know, I mean, there's nothing special there. But, you know, it's one of those, it was from a time, ironically, of all genres, the romantic comedy now is completely dead. And the 80s were not a time that was known to be great for movies, but one thing that they were really, really good for was romantic comedies, and that was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we've made any romantic comedies this decade that were anything close to the kind of romantic comedies they were making then. And I like J-Lo, and I agree with you. I mean, I it's a fine idea. I just want them to do their job with the writing, not go with the lazy jokes, not go with the, you know, the easy, same old rehashed jokes we've heard over and over and over again.
Well, that's what it's going to be. But my point was, and Jerry, you're back on the line again.
Okay, what are we talking about?
We're talking about the remake of Overboard with J-Lo. My point is...
Who's
going
to play the Kurt Russell part?
I have no idea. I think
Mark
her butt.
Anthony?
I think her butt. Her butt will kidnap her.
Okay, I need to really chime in here. What was wrong with the original Overboard that it needs to be updated?
Well, this is my point.
It's a funny movie.
This is my point
about
it. It's fluff. It's harmless fluff. Very few people probably remember it unless you really bring it up and describe it to them. Oh yeah, I might have seen it. But I have
so.
No problem.
I think that movie's held in very fond regard by a lot of people, actually.
Really?
I
know lots of people who are totally into that movie. And by the way, it's one of these movies that shows on cable about six times every week. So it's one of those things that's been ground into our collective subconscious.
Well, I don't have a problem
with them remaking movies that like that, of that ilk.
Look, I need to chime in here because I'm sort of an expert at this category, the romantic comedy. Look, the British make great romantic comedies because they remember what, you know, they're like very cynical and, you know, they don't really, I mean, all right, the second Bridget Jones movie is a fucking travesty. I'm sorry. The first one, they got it right. The second one is just like, my God, could you shut Renee Zellweger up? Please put duct tape over her mouth. But Love Actually. Love Actually is like the goddamn Gone with the Wind of British romantic comedies. It works on every level. But the British do it well, and, you know, the independent cinema in this country has always done it well. Does Overboard need to be remade? Not really. It's a funny movie. It holds up very well 22 years later.
We're beyond
Captain Ron does need to be remade, and I would actually finance that movie right now with Gerard Butler in the lead, and never mind. But...
we're beyond asking whether or not something needs to be remade anymore.
It's going to be remade. I'm surprised that Overboard is the thing that comes to mind, though, because it's like, you know, we know it because it's done very well in cable and home video, obviously. And Kurt and Goldie, you know, that and Swing Shift, they have a great on-screen chemistry. I don't know, who is J-Lo going to act opposite? She only has luck with Clooney. Is the only person that she's really... truly had luck with on screen.
Clooney's not going to do something like this.
Oh, God, no, he's not going to do that. Jesus Christ, he's going to do the, what's that guy's name? Jack Abramoff story before he does that.
Yeah, and Spacey's already done that. But
yeah, I mean, so...
The thing about Overboard is it's just going to be a fluff piece. It's going to be her March-April romantic comedy release, and then we're going to forget about it.
So we're talking about, is the backup plan supposed to be any good, or...
It's going to be.
Now that it has a weekend to itself.
It might. I don't know. Another thing that interested me, I was watching TV yesterday, and there was a movie, Copland. I was watching Copland, and up pops Annabella Sciorra, And she's another one of these whatever happened twos, because I remember seeing her in The Sopranos. She had a recurring role for a while there.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere in the 90s and popping up in all these movies. And then what has she done lately? Can you think of other actors like that?
Well, you can think of more actresses than you can actors.
Yeah.
I think actresses tend to be a little bit more disposable because it's kind of a cliche, but I mean, people say it all the time. You know, I mean, men often age better than women do, physically anyway. That's the truth. A lot of men, certainly movie stars, look better as they get older. They become more distinguished and they look more like, smoldering silverback, you know, like Sean Connery or Warren Beatty or George Clooney. Whereas the women, unfortunately, I don't want to sound like a fucking chauvinist here, but, you know, I mean, Jane Fonda does not look that great. She does not look as good as she used to. So, I mean, I think you can think a lot of more. Annabelle Shiora is a good example. I mean, you could have arguably have put Marissa Tomei into that category up until, you know, The Wrestler came out.
Well, also, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, too, before that, a year before that. But she's, I'm like, looking
no
at
no one saw that.
What?
I said,
no
yeah,
one saw Before
no
the Devil Knows. I know no one saw that, but, you know, she was in, you know, she's been in a couple movies, 12 and Holding, Find Me Guilty. I know these are movies that no one's seen, and, you know, she still acts and everything. You know, I have a problem with this because, you know, the actresses are the ones doing the better job most of the time. Look at Lily Taylor. I think one of the great actresses, one of the great discoveries in the 90s, she's reduced to, I think, two or three scenes in Brooklyn's Finest, which is not a bad movie, by the way. But she really, unfortunately, doesn't have a lot to do in the film.
Why is that that happens to actresses?
It's, dude, in one sense you're right, it's a chauvinistic system, but it's the actresses, I think, who have a lot more to give, or at least they did, at least we were willing to give them more the benefit of the doubt in the old days when we had better scripts and you know, better writers and everything. We don't have that anymore. We have to, like Annabella Shore, if she really wants to make it, it's going to be some screenwriter. His or her first script, I did not mean to make that as a male-oriented thing. It's going to be an independent film. Remember, Edie Falco, who did not make it early in this life, one of her great roles...
Who's also in Copland.
Well, also, is Judy Berlin.
Yeah.
And she is, you know, much older in that film than many actresses, but it's the first probably film role when you think of it, and I don't count Random Hearts because I don't think anyone should, but Judy Berlin or something, you have these, it's in the independent genre where these actresses are going to make their name either for the first time or make it again later. Because mainstream Hollywood, dude, it's a fucking butcher shop. They don't really care.
Well,
but it
kinda
is.
This kind of takes us back to what we were talking about with Gabore Siddique, because whatever the fuck.
God bless her.
I mean, if Annabella Shiora is having a hard time, if Lily Tomlin's having a hard time, Lily Taylor, not Lily Tomlin, if Marissa Tomei's having a hard time, then what chance does, you know, the 300-pound chick have? Like,
no,
zero.
But she can hopefully, let's go to someone like Helen Mirren, who, as she's gotten older, has gotten better parts. You know, I'm not saying that I think The Long Good Friday and Excalibur is really, in one perspective, is her at her best. But I'm watching The Last Station a couple months ago, and I would really put that up against everyone who was nominated for Best Actress nomination. I would really put that up against, I'm sorry, Sandy. You know, I think it's great that DJ Qualls said you were really good, and I'm sure you're a really nice person, and I respect you immensely after that interview. But The Blind Side's a good role for Sandy. I don't think it's the best role. I really thought Helen Mirren gave one of the best performances of the last year, and she just gets better and better every year. I'm the same with Meryl Streep, but the guys, the MBAs running the studios, they don't understand this. They really
don't. Well,
here's
another thing. Here's another thing with actresses in particular.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, whether it's from being discouraged by the opportunities or by having to fight so hard for so little – choose to bow out of it themselves. People
That's
like
true.
People like Bridget Fonda. People like Meg Tilly. Mary Stuart Masterson's moved on to directing because there's no opportunities there for...
Well, look at Lori Petty. She directed a movie 2 years ago, The Poker House. I mean, she got out of the game. And,
right,
you know,
right.
She made some good movies, and, you know, it's a shame because she's... I always thought she was a had a great screen presence, but she decided to go behind the camera, too.
Whatever happened to Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio? You know,
that's a good... What happened to her?
Juliette Lewis can't get arrested. Actually, she probably can get arrested. and people like Mira Sorvino. I know she's still working, but that was like a peak and then just off a cliff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, why isn't she acting more?
Well,
and juicier
she's in a unique
stuff?
Position. She's in a very unique position, though, because she's married or she's with Noah Baumbach. So she's doing a lot more writing these days. But when you watch the Greenberg trailer, and I unfortunately have not seen the film yet, you are reminded in those two or three scenes in the trailer what a dynamic presence she is. God help me if she isn't the coolest thing in the Hudsucker Proxy, Mrs.
Mm-hmm.
Parker in A Vicious Circle. And for that matter, Georgia. Her performance in Georgia is emotionally devastating. Why isn't she more popular?
You're right.
Than she, is?
She used to be. I make her akin to, in the 90s, the female equivalent of Gary Oldman. Very, like, versatile and volatile. And Gary Oldman's another one. I mean, if it wasn't for the Batman movies, we wouldn't be seeing many Gary Oldman performances.
That's
because
true.
He's noted down to, like, obscure films. That's the only interesting stuff he can find.
No, you're absolutely right. Look at someone like Uma Thurman, who
yeah.
spurts, you know, thankfully
does
she? No, she does. And I watched Motherhood a couple weeks ago. I watched The Accidental Husband.
Right.
And she's not fitted for romantic comedy. Motherhood's a little bit better, but The Accidental Husband, she's not fitted for it. But there's no doubt when given the right part, and it seems like QT is the only one writing the right parts for her lately,
right.
She's just – I actually honestly think Uma needs to actually sit down and write her parts for her because here's a dynamic actress, someone who for at least – even well before Pulp Fiction was in a lot of great films, Henry and June, Dangerous Liaisons, and then we're talking about small parts. Even after that, Jennifer 8. Jennifer 8 is before that, Mad Dog and Glory. But – we're looking at these actresses, and Jennifer Jason Leigh is another one, a dynamic force.
I can tell what Uma Thurman's trying to do, though, because she really peaked with Kill Bill. She was this kick-ass heroine, and now she's trying to say, okay, I want to get into this romantic comedy vein like all the biggest actresses right now have. And it's been unsuccessful for her. But there's other people too, great stars that we never hear about, like Pam Dauber in Bananarama.
Well, actually, I hate to break it to you, Jamie, as someone who is Uma's great champion, she peaked with Pulp Fiction. Guys, let me finish here because. Before I was a Dashinologist, I was an Umanologist, so leave this to me. She really, with Pulp Fiction, was actually really like sort of this comeback performance because she really peaked with Munchausen and Dangerous Liaisons. That's what made her great. Those were the roles that
that's
made her
what
great.
Brought her, and that's what brought her to attention.
Yeah. Pulp
but
Fiction
as, in
is
terms of a,
at,
in terms of
Pulp
a defining
Fiction.
Role, you can't get better than Kill Bill.
Yeah, it's
but it's
Bill.
A defining
that's
role
a key,
after so many misses, though.
That's all I was saying.
Oh, okay. I thought, but Kill Bill comes after where people had already written her off. People had written her off long before Kill Bill, and then she comes back. I mean, do people talk about the Golden Bowl? Do they talk about the towel? Do they talk about Chelsea Walls? I do, but or Tate, for that matter. But no one's talking about those before that. But yes, Kill Bill put her on the map in ways that no other film could, and she was very much Marlene Dietrich to his Sternberg. I don't disagree with that analogy at all. But then after that, you know, we see, you know, we got the producers, we got my super ex-girlfriend, we got Prime, and I hear the laughter in the background, and it doesn't work, sadly. So I think it's up, I think Uma actually has a great part in her, but I think she has to write it at this point.
Chris, what are your thoughts about any of this?
Well, number one, I thought Prime was a really good movie. Number two, I definitely agree with you, Jamie, that the peak of her career was Kill Bill. I mean, there's lots of ups and downs, but Kill Bill.
It's a peak, but it's a late.
Also, I think, as we're having this conversation, it occurs to me that, strangely, I think that a lot of female actresses, as they get older, some of the smarter ones, have gone to television. I think
mm-hmm.
that television
yeah.
is a better medium for women when you think about things like The Closer with Kira Sedgwick or
mm-hmm.
The Saving Grace with Holly Hunter or Medium with Patricia Arquette, who, by the way, has put on some pounds, and I think we need to think about the name of that show, maybe bump it up.
Oh, man, you're a cold son of a bitch, man. But
I, think we
I agree with you about television, Chris. I agree with that. And look at Katie Siegel. I think she's made a great leap to television. In that regard.
Right. I do think that there are fewer, when you look back at the history of cinema, there are fewer, for whatever reason, whether you want to put it on the system or you want to put it on our culture or you want to put it on screenwriters, there are very few of those iconic film roles for women. When you think of those iconic roles, when you think of the Vito Corleones and you think of the R.P. McMurphys and you think of, you know, Jack Giddies and all these kind of and Indiana Jones and Han Solo and all these kind of like iconic characters. There are very few female characters like that jump to mind. And when I say very few, very few.
You have to go back. Like the easy ones are the classic
Dorothy.
Films.
Dorothy.
And Gilda and Norma Desmond.
Right.
Maybe something in relatively modern times, something like Alex Forrester in Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, there's some, like Annie Hall. I mean, they're there, but it's very few in comparison to the men.
Yeah.
No, it's a sad state of affairs. I mean...
Is it sad? I mean, I understand the knee-jerk reaction to say that. I understand that, and I don't want to come off...
It's
again,
not a knee-jerk
like
reaction.
No, I mean, I think it is, because in a way, I think that the argument could be made that maybe it's not sad. Maybe that's just the way, as a culture, we are. For some reason, we're more interested in what's going on with male characters than we are with females. Now, that's a fact. We can argue about why it is, and we can argue about whether it's sad or not, but as a culture, we are more interested in the male characters. They're in our politics. They are movie stars, the ones that jump to mind. When you think the word movie star, who do you think of? You think of Brad Pitt. You think of Harrison Ford. You think of George Clooney. Maybe fifth or sixth on the list is somebody like Jennifer Aniston or Meryl Streep or somebody like
that. Well, I would think Meryl Streep. I would never insult Meryl Streep and put Jennifer Aniston in that category.
Well, I think Jennifer Aniston gets kind of a bad rep. I actually think she's a pretty good actress. But
She's good when she applies herself, when she's being Gerald Butler's... PR
right.
slave. I don't. Okay.
You're right
but,
about that.
No, but I'm not. Look, there are a lot of great actresses out there. Hell, look at Parker Posey. She's getting the same bum rap.
Yeah.
And we're not even addressing that. If she goes back to the indie realm, she makes a superb film. Robin Wright Penn is another one that we've forgotten about. But I went and I watched Rebecca Miller's latest film last week, The Secret Lives of the Private
Pepper
Lives
Lee.
Of Pepper Lee. It's a very good, much better than anyone's giving it credit for. And, you know, it's a film that, you know, it can't get a wide release given the way our society works. But it's a fascinating film. But I think it's the parts that are available to women, sadly. I think in another time that we had better parts coming to women. Katharine Hepburn in Summertime. I don't know if we could have that today, which is a very sad state of affairs.
They're just placed on a separate kind of – they're placed in another room. Because
right.
anytime there's a good, strong female character, like a Pippa Lee or something, that's the first thing they'll say. This was a good, strong female character. They'll never
right.
say Ryan Bingham in Up in the Air is a good, strong male character.
No, you're right.
You know?
You're absolutely right. I don't know
true.
If that's a good, strong male character.
Well,
though,
yeah. I don't think it is, but...
No, that Ryan Bingham character is just a bland character that we really have. People were sort of snowed by that movie and sort of felt like that was totally original, and I thought it was a decent movie, but we've seen that character in five or six other movies that I could rattle off the top of my head. Whereas there are no female characters in movies like that that all of a sudden get this. All of a sudden, there's this new kind of female character. I mean, Greenberg. Greenberg
okay.
is an example. Like this is. I haven't seen the movie either, but by all accounts, it's like, oh, this is a character like you've never seen before, and this is Ben Stiller playing a kind of, you know, against the grain. You just don't get that with. You don't get a female-driven movie like Greenberg. You can't get whatever the female equivalent name would be. You know, like they don't pop up.
Another one that just popped in my head, a woman that went to television that used to be big in movies, Elizabeth Perkins.
Yeah,
she's
yeah,
really
very
big gold there.
Well, yeah. And Mary, and the other one from Weeds, whatever her name is.
Mary Louise
Parker. Yeah.
Right.
But here are two actresses that they're not big actresses, they're not house brand names in one sense, but Joan Allen and Laura Linney. Joan Allen in The Upside of Anger, Off the Map, and yes, in the middle part of the last decade, three really powerful performances, and two of those films no one has ever heard of, but they are very powerful performances. Tilda Swinton in Julia, and more importantly, The Deep End, and these are, you know, older performances, mature performances, and then there's Laura Linney, who just sort of comes out of left field and blows everyone away. But, you know, there's a reason. These films are not, the roles that I'm talking about are not popular roles. They're not the things that are going to make people get up in the morning and go buy a ticket ahead of time.
But they have found their niche. Because with Tilda Swinton, I mean, she does an occasional big-budget studio film with really strong directors because they know she's got the goods from doing stuff like Julia. Almost like Cassavetes raw performances that she is in those movies. Joan Allen has factored a career much like Helen Mirren has.
She really has.
With her work. And the other one you mentioned, not Joan Allen.
Laura Linney.
Laura Linney. Fantastic. Chris, have you seen Breach yet?
I have, yes. I liked Breach quite a bit.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah. The other... great now. Now, of course, the name escapes me. But these actresses, as I mentioned, these are roles that are, you know, they're not box office draws. The movies are not box office draws, but they are very strong performances from these women who are not, you know, they're not on the cover of Vogue all the time or on the, you know, but they are really the truly great actress performances of the last decade, the last two decades, for that matter. But I don't know where it leads to because they're not roles. You know, you mentioned Julia. Julia never got a wide release. I think maybe one city, and it was on Netflix instant viewing. That's how I saw it. It never came around me. So.
Well, which is good because that's how most people would be able to see a movie like that or inclined to see a movie like that from a service like Netflix. I saw two more movies I want to just briefly bring up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Once again, I have to mention Cobra.
I noticed that today. You're on the Cobra kick.
By happenstance, Cobra was on Cinemax, or Retro Channel today, and man, in such a depressed mood as I've been, I turn on Cobra, and I just felt giddy. That's good. It's the greatest bad movie ever for me. Nonstop mayhem and laughter to be found in that. Do you think that that's Stallone's shining achievement, Chris?
Cobra's up there. Yeah, I mean, I would have to go with Cobra. It's his shining achievement as Stallone, not as Sylvester Stallone the actor, but as the iconic 80s, just the last name Stallone. Cobra is the movie. Because there's other movies he made that are actually pretty good. We talked about Copland earlier. I think Nighthawks is a pretty good movie.
Nighthawks is a great movie.
He's made some decent movies, but we don't remember those. We remember Cobra.
We celebrate Cobra.
We remember Over the Top, you know. We remember stuff like that. But of those types, I do think that it doesn't get better or worse, however you want to put it, than Cobra.
Oh, God.
All right, what are the two movies besides Cobra? Was there two others that you want to talk about?
Well, I also, one of my favorite movies from the 90s. Was The Doctor, and that was on the other day, and I rewatched that, and what a beautiful movie, and elevated completely by William Hurt, just like he elevated Accidental Tourist. Such a great movie, and not obvious, and I'm always reminded of a review I read, because Regarding Henry was about similar themes, and I remember a critic at our local paper saying that Regarding Henry is so much better, essentially, because it's more obvious, the transformation.
Yeah.
And it was such a, like, it's such a kind of internal transformation that happens with William Hurt and the Doctor. That's why he's perfectly suited for it, because he's such an internal actor.
Yeah, right. It's a bad analogy, really, if you ask me. I know those movies came out about the same time, but William Hurt...
William Hurt is so subtle. It's almost like he forgets to act. He's odd.
Like his reactions to people and what they say and in scenes, and it just makes it so much more interesting and alive. The fact that he in his best roles, he's like an alien from another planet.
And
he's assimilating these feelings for the first time. Even if you go to something like I Love You to Death.
But that's a very good movie, actually. I don't know if I really want to be the guy that makes a comparison between Hurt and Ford. That's not a ground I'd ever really feel comfortable being on, and especially those two movies. There's a lot of people who say that Regarding Henry is an awful movie.
It is.
I would not compare those two. I think it's a bad analogy.
I don't think it's an awful movie. I just think it's an obvious movie. I think it's a movie from a 16-year-old screenwriter, J.J. Abrams. And it does its job, and I think Ford does exactly what he needs to do in that movie.
Yeah, but and that's fine, but like William Hurt, and for a lot of our younger listeners probably don't know this, but in the 80s and in the early 90s, William Hurt was really one of our greatest actors. He still is a great actor, but at that time, he was the shit. No one had a problem with him. When he was on, no one could touch him in mainstream Hollywood. He's an excellent actor. Just look at Kiss of the Spider Woman. Forget everything else. Just look at that movie. He's incredible in that.
And the original actor that was supposed to play the Doctor was Warren Beatty.
I remember that, it would be interesting. Is Warren ever going to act again?
We talked about that. If he does...
I know.
If he does, he has a thing about not acting in a movie that he doesn't direct. His ego won't allow him to be anything less than Orson Wellesian about it. So it would be the Howard Hughes thing if he acts again. But William Hurt is back with The Yellow Handkerchief, which is another great acclaimed performance.
Mm-hmm.
So people are talking, you know, slowly about him again.
No, that's good, because he's really one of the greats.
Go ahead, Chris. What?
I said that's ironic because he talks slowly.
Okay. In a little bit, we're going to close out with this mystery movie score of the week. Upcoming shows, we have actor Stephen Root. You might remember him from Office Space, No Country for Old Men, and he's been in a ton of movies. He's in the movie Men Who Stare at Goats, which is coming out on DVD on Tuesday, and he's going to come by to promote that. We got some Sarasota Film Festival stuff coming up. We have the 3-year anniversary of Movie Geeks United coming up, and the new classic series 7, where we celebrate David Fincher's movie 7. Chris.
Yeah.
Would you happen to have anywhere nearby you access to William Friedkin?
William Friedkin? Wow. You know, he's always hanging around the neighborhood somewhere. The thing about Friedkin is he needs a challenge, essentially.
Yeah.
Friedkin never pops up unless he never stops by my place unless someone makes some sort of claim about something that's happened in history of film,
yeah.
or someone makes some sort of observation or gives him a compliment. That's it. I can always depend on Friedkin to drop by when something like that happens, you know.
Well, then I would say that something like Jerry, help me out here. Jerry, you
wait, are
they
remaking The Exorcist?
Yeah, I would say that something like To Live and Die in L.A., which was just recently released on Blu-ray.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who's gonna buy that for me?
It was it doesn't age well, and that other cop drug thug movies have taken its place in the pantheon of great of that great genre of film. That's what I would
say.
Wow.
You know,
I'm gonna go slit my wrist now.
Hold on a second.
I'm just saying that because I want him to stop in.
Right.
For those out there, while you go get him.
He's going to stop in.
For those of you out there that don't know who William Friedkin is, William Friedkin is the egomaniacal, and I will call him that to his face, director of The Exorcist, The Fringe Connection, and the To Live and Die in L.A., and not a damn good movie since then.
What about Bug?
Wow.
You didn't like Bug?
Yeah, I did like Bug. Shh,
okay, so come on, man. You know?
Don't tell him, though. So I want Friedkin. Can we get Friedkin on the line?
Excuse me. Hold on just a second.
You're going to get worse than you got, man.
All right.
Put the phone down for a second.
Okay. This is always so exciting when Friedkin stops by. Play long, Jerry.
Hello. Hey.
Yes.
Hello.
Mr. Friedkin.
Hey, Friedkin. What's up, man?
Yes, who's this?
This is Jamie and Jerry from Movie Geeks United. We've spoken in the past.
Oh, yeah, I do remember now. I do remember, yes.
Yeah. Well, we have been Friedkin out here today because we've been talking about Whatever Happened to Stars, and that enters the realm of directors, too. We're wondering whatever happened to you because you seem to be from the 70s directors that were great and did great work. You seem to have become a footnote, or a has-been in a way. What's your response to that?
A has-been. Well, it's interesting. You see, the reason I'm not getting offered projects anymore is, see, I did everything already. I did it all. There's nothing anyone could do that I haven't done already.
Right.
They're going to remake The Exorcist, I hear. See, no one had done that before I did it. I did it first, baby. No one had ever put an 11-year-old girl in her panties covered in pea soup on a bed before. I did it. First.
Yeah.
Would
you say that is your
movie like?
Would you say that that's your shining achievement?
Oh no, I don't know. I would have to say The Guardian was probably probably my best movie, underrated, misunderstood, of course, by American audiences. Did very, very well in France and Indonesia.
I really like Sorcerer.
Yeah, well, Sorcerer, you know, of course. That's one that I can't say no one had ever done that before because, of course, it was a remake. So it's the one time in my career when someone had done something before me. But I was the first one to remake. No one had ever remade the movie before I remade it. So
No, this is very good. I enjoyed it.
Right, yeah, of course. So
you don't consider The Exorcist your shining moment? Because that's pretty sad if your shining moment happened 40 years ago, and you're still working.
Well, I've made plenty of movies that Gene Shalit called Rules of Engagement pleasantly surprising. I don't know if you remember it, but Ben Lyons called Bug extremely entertaining. These are reviews that not everyone would remember, but, you know, a filmmaker realizes when he's hit his peak, and I know that I haven't hit my peak yet. I'll be making another movie here shortly that I'm very excited about. Naturally, no one's ever done anything like it before. It's going to be one of a kind. It's going to be, it's going to make Citizen Kane look like Meatwally Sparks, basically. That's what it's going to be.
Well, there's one filmmaker that's done something like no one has ever done before recently, and that's James Cameron. Does Cameron's success make you a bit jealous?
Oh, you know, I know Jim Cameron, and between you and me, between you and me, Jim Cameron couldn't direct his ass out of a paper bag. The guy doesn't make a movie. First of all, look, all the guy's movies start with A and T. Never made a movie that didn't start with A or T. Literally,
that's
look it up.
That's very true. That's a good point.
It's true.
I never even thought of that.
It's true, he made Piranha 2, but he was fired. Guess what? I've never been fired from a movie before. Oh, they tried. They tried many times. But, you know, Jim Cameron, you know, he makes movies about blue people. I understand with the 3D glasses and stuff, and people are into that. But sooner or later, people are going to want, you know, a good old Friedkin movie, and I'll be here to deliver it, you know. And then no one can deliver a Friedkin movie like I can.
Well,
you know
what's
what?
What's on tap for you? What are you doing?
Oh, well, you know, I don't talk about these kinds of things until they're ready to go, because I've got so many things on the burner right now. You know, I've got a biopic about the fellow who did the Micro Machines commercial. That's going to be coming out soon. A very interesting life that this fellow lived. I've got a 6-hour film about the Tangerine, which is a documentary, of course. You know, no one's ever made a movie about citrus before. And
well, I mean, not quite like that. No, I mean,
Not at all, Jerry. It's never been done. It's never been done. So, you know, I've got a lot of things on the burner. You know.
Well, I know where Troy Duffy gets his inspiration. Huh? I mean,
Friedkin, Mr. Friedkin. We were talking about Avatar earlier, and of course that's in 3D, and that's why it made such a big splash. One of the reasons why. You actually invented 3D. It's something that people don't know. But could you talk about possibly that and some other things that you've invented that you haven't been given credit for?
Oh, sure. No, there's many others. Not only in the realm of cinema. You know, I mean, absolutely, I invented 3D. That's documented. It's provable. But I invented numerous other things. I was actually the founder of the Mazda company. I spent some time in Tokyo, and I started the Mazda company. All those cars, my idea. I invented the light bulb. You know, people give credit to Edison on that one. Not true. That's mine. You know, there's so many. I can't think of them all. Oakley sunglasses. You know, I remember wearing a pair of sunglasses on the set of The Exorcist. Caught my reflection in a mirror, and I thought, well, you know, these sunglasses should really have a rainbow on the outside of them, so people could see how colorful I am. And that's where Oakley's came from, really. And now all the NASCAR fellows are wearing them. You know, there's so much. I'm inventing something right now, you know, as we speak. I'm always inventing something.
Okay, last
question.
I'm
glad to hear that. No, can I get a free pair of Oakley sunglasses and a Mazda?
No, there's some litigation going on right now. Naturally, they're trying to take it away from me. They're trying to act like I'm not the one who is behind it.
Can I get a Blu-ray of Sorcerer at least?
Oh, well, if it were on Blu-ray, I would gladly give you one, unfortunately.
Okay, that's cool. No, I'm just glad. Thanks for showing up, man.
I wanted to ask you before you left, Mr. Friedkin. So we were discussing your output as of late, the past 20 or so years, and classifying you as a has-been, perhaps unfairly so. But
I would say definitely unfairly.
How would you classify your contribution and what your legacy will be?
Oh, you can't put a price on legacy. You can't talk about legacy right now. As far as my output, how would you classify it? I would probably be a little modest and use a word like legendary. I would probably say something like that. Unparalleled comes to mind. Again, modest. These are modest terms that come to mind. No one was making movies the way I was making them. You understand? No one ever made something like Jade with David Caruso.
Oh yeah, that's right. You made that. Can I have my money back for that?
Well, no, I don't give refunds for Jade anymore. I lost a lot of money that way. But
I bet you did. Yeah, I can understand.
Yeah, no one had ever made a movie that bad before, and that's what I set out to make. That's what I made.
The worst car chase ever filmed.
Right. The worst car chase ever filmed. And no one had ever done that before. And naturally, there's no category for that at the Academy Awards. But I'm making a picture with my wife right now. We're working on something together. It's very exciting. We'll be talking about it soon. But.
Well, you'll have to come back and tell us about it, yeah.
Oh, naturally. I'll be the first to do that.
All right, Mr. Friedkin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
If we could get Chris back, that would be great.
Hold on 1 minute.
All right.
Hello.
Hey, bud. That was exciting. Thanks for bringing
that
it on.
That was very exciting. Thank you. I had no idea.
Yeah, I think I should have had a couple more drinks before I got freaking on the line.
Yeah, always a good idea.
I really like the idea of the 6-hour documentary on the tangerine.
Yeah, I want to see that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the kind of angles that he explores there.
Okay. Okay. What are we excited about when we close off here? Are we excited about any movies or events or what's going on? Oh, you know, event coming up at Sarasota Film Festival.
Yeah, what's going on?
I didn't discuss in the last show.
Their
movie maker that they're having the tribute series to this year is John Landis.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
Well, you know me. I have a thing about John Landis. He's like the one guy that I refuse to interview.
Oh, come on, dude. Come on, man. I know you don't like Jason Reitman either, but come on.
No, Jason Reitman, I'll interview anyone. But
you won't interview Landis. Now, let me ask you this. Is it because that you really respect and honor Vic Morrow's acting legacy?
No, but it is the Vic Morrow.
You son of a bitch.
It is the Vic Morrow thing.
No, I know it is the Vic Morrow thing. Okay, wow.
So why would I interview Polanski and not Landis? First of all, Polanski would be international news, and I'm willing to let go of my morals, whatever morals I have. But Landis is a different thing. I've always viewed him as like an arrogant prick, that arrogance cost an actor and 2 children their lives.
That's true, and here's the thing. It's fine to either interview or not interview John Landis. That's one thing. We can argue all day long about whether that's okay. But to celebrate the work of John Landis?
is he doing something? Is this because of the Don Rickles documentary?
No, this is because he's just made another movie with Simon Pegg.
Yeah. Do you understand what I mean, though? Like,
No, I understand what you mean. It's a dicey situation because the past is prologue and everything, but the Twilight Zone incident, tragedy as it is a big deal, and it is, largely forgotten by many people.
And it is largely, I do place large blame on him for it.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of career and accomplishments in career, that's what you're talking about, Chris. You're talking about, that's not really a full career worthy of tribute. Is that what you're saying,
right,
Chris?
Right, no. Right, absolutely. No, he definitely started off an interesting career, made some pretty good comedies. But number one, even if he just continued to make those types of comedies throughout an entire career, I would already if he'd continued to make those for the last 20 years, and he hasn't been, but I would already question the decision to celebrate his films. But I just don't feel like he really put in the small amount of time that he was making mainstream movies. I don't feel like he put enough of a stamp on his work. You know, I've never watched a movie of his and thought, this feels like a John Landis movie. You know what I mean?
Well,
I feel like there's
you're wrong there. You're wrong there.
The horror
Are
comedy?
Animal House, Kentucky Fried Movie, Coming to America, which is arguably Eddie Murphy's last great film. I mean,
right. No, those are good movies, but what I'm arguing is that there's nothing there that feels distinctly John Landis. I don't think that there's a style there. I mean,
oh,
it's just between...
there's a style. There's a style, though. I'm not saying this to be... I'm not saying that there's a style to be... I'm not doing this, as I was criticized a couple of years ago by Jamie and Aaron for putting George Romero and John Carpenter on the pedestal, but there is a style. There is a John Landis style. There really is, and I think you just missed that. Yes, it is horrible that Vic Morrow and Two Children are dead because of the Twilight Zone.
I don't give a fuck about Vic Morrow. I'm not like
Well, I do care about Vic Morrow. Okay, Humanoids from the Deep, baby. Okay, I do care about Vic Morrow. Okay,
well,
I really do.
Well, that's fine. I'm just saying I disagree with you. I think you're wrong. I don't think you're
wrong. Let me tell you this. If you don't have John Landis, you don't have what comedies do you have? Maybe you have Ivan Reit. Ivan Reitman is the other half of that equation. But what do you have? You don't have anything that we've been. You don't have Judd Apatow. You don't have Wedding Crashers. You don't have any of that. You needed John Landis there to make those movies, because if you didn't have Animal House, son, you would have nothing. You would have nothing.
Okay, Chris, rebuttal.
Number one, go back and watch Animal House. It's not that funny. And
no, it is that funny, Chris. And the problem is, you need to get the stick out of your ass and realize it's funny. Okay?
Don't
this revisionist shit that Animal House is not funny.
No, it's not funny.
Go ahead, Chris.
It's really just not that funny. There's just not that much there. Now, it's true, John Belushi is funny, but the movie, pound for pound, does not have that many laughs in it. Now, I will admit that Coming to America does have laughs in it, but are those laughs, is it a style born of John Landis that makes that funny, or is it Eddie Murphy at the top of his game that makes that funny? I would argue that it's Eddie Murphy, certainly not John Landis. And as far as Kentucky Fried Movie goes, it's not funny, period, end of discussion. It's not funny.
I like Kentucky Fried Movie. I just think a Kentucky Fried Movie is funny because it's the Zucker Brothers.
Spies Like Us, and I know no one likes that movie, but look at Spies Like Us. Look at the Blues Brothers. These are the movies that really define. These are the subversive movies, because if you don't have these movies, you don't have anything. You have
Blues Brothers is the one time when I would agree with you, and again, I do not think there's nothing wrong with Blues Brothers. I think it's a really good movie, but I think the strength of Blues Brothers is Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, as well as the music, and not John Landis. There's no style born of John Landis that makes it work. Put it this way, it's not the same thing as John Hughes.
It's a different thing.
It's not Judd Nelson and Molly Ringwald and Emilio Estevez that makes Breakfast Club work. It's John Hughes. It's not Matthew Broderick and Alan Ruck and whatever the chick's name from Ferris Bueller is that makes that movie work, Mia Sara. It is John Hughes. And again, you want to talk about Ivan Reitman. Like, I think you could sort of make the same argument for Ivan Reitman. It's not Ivan Reitman that makes Ghostbusters work. It's the Ghostbusters. It's not him that makes Strikes work. It's Bill Murray and Harold Ramis and John Candy and
I think you had two directors, two different directors, who harnessed that. I really got to say, if you didn't, another director, I don't know, but it's John Landis is there on all those films. Yes, it is a tragedy that we have Beverly Hills Cop 3. Yes, you can argue that the form of the Stupids, I think, didn't he direct that too? Yes, we're watching a career in decline. But let's watch something like Into the Night. I'm sorry, there is a style there. It's not a style that we're used to talking about on this show. It's not this remedial pretentiousness, but it's there.
My opinion on it is I've never really liked his movies anyway. I mean, outside
of the Twilight Zone. Well, we know that, Jamie. I know that. You don't need to be Sam Spade to figure that out.
Yeah, but I would say that he has had his influence, and his influence peaked almost 30 years ago. So I don't know that there's a large enough body of work to give a tribute to him.
Exactly.
I don't know about a tribute. I don't know about that. I don't know how Sarasota works. I don't know who they're sleeping with.
But let's not forget the other Landis.
Last year was Hal Ashby. You've gone from Hal Ashby to John Landis.
Yeah, but Hal Ashby made 8 Million Ways to Die, okay? So I'm not going to...
Yeah, and,
I mean,
and every
not,
other movie
no,
he
no,
made
I'm not gonna go
there. Was brilliant.
I'm not going to go. But he also made American Werewolf in London.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Again. Now, I love American Werewolf in London. We all like to remember that as being a really good movie. Now, what do you remember about that movie? Is it the whole movie, or is it the transformation scene that people remember about that movie? I remember that stuff, too, and I like that stuff. But if that movie does not have that transformation scene, if it just had a shitty, like the Lon Chaney, camera trickery bullshit, that movie
no,
is not
dude,
remembered.
It's a funny
we are
movie.
Not talking about that movie right now. Now we are
no,
not talking
it is.
About
we are.
Movie
it's
without
a funny
the
movie. I'm not talking about the transformation. I'm talking about the actual thing. He took this the at the time. There's all this gore centric, and it is a very gross movie. But he made it funny. And I have to give him props for that. I have to give
you
him
know,
props
the,
for a lot of the stuff he did.
The one
but
thing that we
do
talk
I think
about
he deserves a tribute. I don't know. I don't know how Sarasota works. It sounds almost as bad as the coalition authority in the Green Zone. But I think to just dismiss Landis out of hand and his influence is a mistake. Those
not,
films really are really important.
Landis. Those movies are good. I know I hesitate to use the word important, but those movies are
well,
good.
Well, no, Chris, no, you bring up a good point. Why not use the term important? I mean, if we're doing this show, if this show is our thing, the thing that we do every week, then we do have to really say, each of us, to what is our important thing. And it would be a mistake to dismiss Landis and his films, because those films are important. I don't care
no.
who you are. No, they're not. I don't give a shit about the Oscar winners or who we've paid tribute to in the past. And I don't want to pay tribute to Landis. He's the last person I want to pay tribute to. But the films, those films influenced all of us, whether you wanted to admit it or not. Animal House was what we thought college would be. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean,
no.
Can you think of a funnier film?
Yes, I can.
Think
of lots of funnier films.
Well, I know you
films.
Can, but, you know, that's...
I feel the same way about this show. I feel the same way about the way we talk about movies, and I remember movies fondly, but because we do this show, that's why I think it's important to differentiate between movies that we like and we remember fondly and movies that we consider to be important. I think those are
but they're not. I don't believe in the distinction between those because they're one and the same to me. Remember what I said, the most important thing I ever said on this show in its 3-year history is I am a fascist when it comes to my views and what I like.
Well,
and
so
I will defend
I.
Animal House to the very fullest because it is important, it's funny, it's something I like, but it deserves to be at the top of the game there. And I'm not going to because I had some – I mean, I heard this argument from someone about Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. It wasn't as funny as I remembered. No, it is important. It deserves to be at the forefront. And I don't know – like I said, I don't know how Sarasota works. I don't know why they've gone from Ashby to Landis. That's a mystery to me. I don't know how you make that – how you go – from Ashby to Landis, but to dismiss Animal House in its importance to comedy is a mistake.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I just can't buy it.
For argument's sake, let's say I believe you about Animal House and I agree with you. That one movie is not – that one movie does not attribute make. You know, like that's not enough. To tribute the man at a certainly not
oh,
on the heels of Hal Ashby.
Look,
I think Jerry agrees with that.
I agree with that, but I can't dismiss Landis and his role in American comedy because I think American comedy, as far as cinema is concerned, would look vastly different.
No,
would
I
look. We would not
I
have.
Disagree.
And, I think it has to do with luck too.
Any schmo could have made that movie.
I think it has to do with luck. He was lucky to get in with. The SNL
right.
crowd with Belushi, he was lucky to get hired to do Michael Jackson's Thriller. He has
right.
done some works that have changed the direction of stuff, and like anyone's career, a lot of it has to do with luck, even more so than individual voice.
He's the Brett Ratner of his time. I do not think
No, he's not the Brett Ratner of his time. That's dismissive.
No,
come on, Chris,
no
you don't believe that. You really
do believe
don't
it.
believe
I do believe
you
it.
You really
no
don't
difference.
Believe that.
There's no defining characteristic to his work of any kind. I just don't see any defining characteristic to the works of John Landis. I have trouble saying the phrase "works of John Landis" without giggling. Like there's
no. Well, no. I mean, no. I think if you look, there is a all right. There is a defining characteristic in the and it is about the subversion of authority in all those films: Animal House, The Blues Brothers, Spies Like Us, Into the Night. And even in American Werewolf in London. Now, someone has brought in Thriller in the chat room. I don't give a rat's ass about Thriller. I really don't. I think it is an important music video and all that, but I really just, all these years later, I really don't care.
Okay, we've got 10 seconds left. I know this is the part of the show that everyone's been looking forward to, the movie score.
God knows I've been looking forward to it.
This has been great.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time. Chris, you want to join us for the 7 tribute?
Yeah, when is it?
Wednesday.
Whenever it is, I'll do it, sure.
All right, bud. Here's the mystery movie score. Thank you, guys. This was a great, energetic show.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.